Hello everyone, and a warm spring welcome back to Footprints. This episode is all about the ups and downs of Bath, and it's debatable how many downs there are in Bath. Some say seven and others say nine, but today we're going to visit three of them. Howard Burton has written a book about Charmy Down, and we'll hear about its use during and after the Second World War, and some of the stories he's found out about that are connected to it. Lansdowne is our second down, and we'll discover its ancient past with Mike Williams and hear about a new access trail from Nicol Dor, Cotswold National Landscape. But first, let's start up on Banner Down with the Secretary of the Banner Down Freeholders Association, Rob Kendall. Now, Banner Down sits up above Bath Easton and has been common land since the early 18th century. Here's Rob to show us around.
Where we're stood is the, what we call the Long Meadow. Banner Down is towards the southern end of the Cotswold National Landscape. We're about 200 metres above sea level. And the underlying rock, the geology, is oolitic limestone, laid down in the Jurassic period. So we're talking 350-something million years ago. We're about 3 miles to the east of Bath, and we're just north of Bath Easton. The common does extend almost down into the village, certainly to the edge of the village. Traditionally, common land is land that is owned by the local manor, and it's a piece of land that is probably not very productive, and so the lord of the manor would very kindly let the locals go and use it for grazing, and with permission they'd be allowed to take wood and stone from or soil. So there were different types of commoners who had permission to do different things. But normally it's all about grazing. But about 300 years ago, the manor in Bath Easton was disbanded, and a bunch of people got together, called themselves the Freeholders, and they claimed the ownership for the village. There is a deed from 1719, and they would then charge a small rent to farmers and livestock owners to, if they brought their cattle on here to graze. And that money would go towards helping the poor people within the village. So it was a real community sort of project, if you like, back in the day. And the Bath Easton Freeholders Association has continued right up to today. There's about 10 of us on the committee. We have a chairman and I'm the secretary. In order to manage this land, we have a countryside stewardship with DEFRA, Natural England. That started in 2009. Through that, we are given a management plan, and that tells us how much grazing we can do and what areas of scrub we need to manage. And it is also really all about the meadows. So the meadows on Banner Down here is about 6 hectares. The grassland and meadow used to be a much bigger area. Back in the sort of early 1900s, there wouldn't have been any woodland at all here at all. There's some big quarries here, or there were some big quarries, and people were using the land, and trees that were here were probably chopped down and used for firewood. So a lot of work has gone on in the last 15 years to reclaim the meadow that we have here. So we can actually get a tractor on here and we do a hay cut in the late summer, thanks to help from a local farmer. It will grow to about knee height, the grasses. It's a calcareous grassland meadow. Calcareous is the stone, a limestone. Of course, we're on the Cotswolds. So to have limestone calcareous meadow is quite rare. I mean, meadows up and down the country are rare. these days. Since the 1930s, I think, about 97% of meadows have been lost. And the important thing is that this land hasn't been what they call improved with the use of chemicals. So we have lots of invertebrates, lots of insects, butterflies, birds, and wildflowers. And it's a whole ecosystem. The woodland and the scrub is really all part of that. There's six different types of orchid. The most common ones is the early purple and the common spotted. Twayblades is another orchid, which very pale green. But when you get close to them, it's the same with a lot of wildflowers. You know, they're absolutely fascinating. Pyramidal orchids, we have a lot of those. They're quite an intense sort of purple colour with a little pyramid-shaped flower head. Really gorgeous. We have some bee orchids, very difficult to find, but they are there. And in the last few years, we've been getting a southern marsh orchid. Now, this is not marshland, but so quite why it's called that, I don't know. But they are absolutely stunning. April time, we get lots of cowslips. We can see where we stood. We're then going into lots of other meadow flowers, crane's bill and sheepspit scabiouses. And on the western side of the common, the land drops away and there are some very old trees, ancient trees, 200-300 years old, big ash trees and some elms, quite a few oaks, old oaks. But we call it the wild wood. About 30% of the woodland is ash, and I'm sure a lot of people will have heard of ash dieback. We started to see it here in about 2019, and it's getting progressively more widespread. Hopefully some trees will prove to be resilient, and we monitor the trees every year. And I have an absolutely brilliant team of chainsaw volunteers, and one of those guys is a professional tree inspector. Where we have a tree which is next to an area that is used by people, we will make a decision on whether we need to manage it. But we will only do that when it becomes a risk and a threat because it's dying off. If it's further into the woodland, we will leave the tree, allow it to die naturally. And standing deadwood is a really important habitat for wildlife. Woodpeckers, tree creepers, nuthatches. And as the tree dies, it begins to break down. You get beetles and all sorts of insects beginning to sort of colonise it. It will then fall over and begin to rot naturally down into the ground because trees, I think most people know, hold a lot of carbon. And by allowing them to decay naturally into the ground, the idea is that carbon goes into the ground. I mean, I'm sure people will have heard of the concept of rewilding. Super idea, and it has turned a lot of nature conservation practices on their head because it's all about letting nature look after itself. And if you've got a big enough area, it will do that without you having to do anything. But you do need a whole host of different animals that will graze the land, and dig up, you know, so pigs will sort of dig up the ground and eat worms and what have you, and create hollows, and all of that sort of works really well. But you do need the herbivores, and you need some quite big animals, and a lot of them, to make it work in a rewilding concept. Clearly, we can't do that here, so us humans have to step in and do a bit of management work to look after the place. There's a little bit of a story about a gentleman called Mr. Hobbs. He recorded or wrote down some his recollections from when he was a child back in the 1880s. And he used to help with tending livestock on the common. He was actually from London originally. But he said there were four of us lads on the hill with two cows and two sheep. There were not many bushes. So this is going back into the 1880s, remember. There were not many bushes, just a few lower down the hill, and the rest was grassland. Men were working in the quarries, and the stone was used for building some houses down in Batheaston. It was really quite a change for me from London, the lovely hills and the birds. I never tired of looking at the views and listening to the wind playing tunes in the grass and rushes. There were many different kinds of birds on Banner Down, and men would come out from Bath with cages and decoy birds to catch the wild birds, but after a time this was stopped. I was very impressed with the peewits. They would pretend to be lame in order to try and get me to try and catch them, and in that way they led me away from the nest and their young. And skylarks do that as well up on Salisbury Hill. So there were also corncrakes, which are definitely not found anywhere around here anymore. But these birds have now disappeared, killed off by the mowing machines and the cutting of grass. But then he goes on, what I liked the best of all, was to lie down in the grass and see the changing colours in the sky. The light seemed to come in waves, and it seemed to open and shut. I was never tired of the beauty of it all. And it's still here.
Oh, what a way to start the programme. And if you'd like to experience some of the delights of Banner Down, just remember there's a small car park up on Banner Down Road, otherwise known as the Foss Way. And if you'd like to volunteer with them, you can visit the Banner Down website. Details are in the show notes. Now let's head over to Lansdown and see what the Cotswold National Landscape and Bathscape are doing to improve access up there. Nicole Dorr met me at the start of the new Tramper Trail between the racecourse and the golf course and told me all about it.
So we are stood on a piece of footpath that was recently surfaced as part of a Lansdown on the Level route. The whole route, if you were to start at the park and ride, is a 6-mile route that takes you all around Lansdown to some of the really lovely viewpoints. But the bit that we're stood on is part of a shorter 2-mile loop, which is accessible for off-road mobility scooters, or a tramper is sometimes called as well. And it's been created so that everyone, or more people, can get to see the lovely views from here towards Bristol, and then as you go round over the other side as well.
It's a beautiful place, isn't it, Lansdown? And for walkers who don't want to puff and pant going up and downhill, it's perfect. You can go a very long way, completely flat, and see, I mean, where we're stood now, if we look in the opposite direction, I think we can see the Salisbury Plain.
Yeah, you can see Little Salisbury Hill, and you can see, if we were a little bit further on the brow of the hill there, we'd be able to see Charmy Down as well.
Oh, Charmy Down, we've got that in the episode. So this is the Tramper Trail, and it's fully open now and finished?
Yeah, it's fully open, and all the information's on the Bathscape website. If people search for Lansdown on the Level, they'll be able to see the 6-mile route. But as I said, there's 2 miles within it, which is a loop starting and finishing at the racecourse. The racecourse have given special permission for people to park there if they need to do just the accessible part of it. They just ask that you phone ahead and let them know that you're coming. But anybody else who wanted to do the longer one or doesn't have to worry about the access side of things can do it from the park and ride.
And how many accessible routes like this are there in and around Bath now?
Well, Bathscape and I have put together a handful, but there are constantly ones being developed, and particularly for us as at the Cotswolds National Landscape, we're really trying to work harder on opening up the countryside to as many different types of people as possible, and making it accessible is one of those. So there's little pockets here and there, and there's a few actually written up. Walks on Wheels is another one that you can look up through Disabled Ramblers. They have a really good website with walks on as well. And particularly the Disabled Ramblers are really brilliant at filming their accessible routes with someone who's using a tramper. So you can then decide for yourself if it's right for you, if it's the right sort of thing for you. And they're all uploaded onto Google Maps as well.
So you just said using a tramper. So is a tramper a thing?
Yeah, a tramper is like a brand name for an off-road mobility scooter. So it just allows you, people that are not able to walk far or not able to work at all, to get out into the countryside because it's got that capability of going off-road.
Walks on wheels, disabled ramblers, Lansdowne on the level and Bathscape, all of those, Google and you can find out about accessible walking in the Bathscape. Thanks so much to Nicole Dorr there. Now, listeners will have heard of Bath's great architect, John Wood the Elder. But besides designing some of Bath's Georgian buildings, he was also convinced that there were the remains of Druidic temples up on Lansdowne. Local historian and friend of the podcast, Mike Williams, has done his own research on this, and he met me up on Lansdowne to show me what John Wood had found and to tell me whether or not they had anything to do with Druids.
John Wood, he was a fantastic architect. He is probably one of the best architects ever to have been produced in Britain, and his buildings still stand the test of time. But he had an amazing imagination, which lend itself well to a career such as being an architect, but his other pursuit was ancient history. He was what we now call an antiquary, and he was obsessed with all the ancient monuments he found lying around in the Bath landscape. And his very first commission was to survey Stanton Drew stone circles, and he also did Stonehenge shortly afterwards. And he attributed it to some enterprising druid who built it. And a few years later, he wrote a book called An Essay Towards a Description of Bath, in which this enterprising druid had become King Bladud, the legendary founder of Bath. So John Wood, 7 years after his first edition of that book, he wrote a greatly expanded second edition, which really, really goes into the full extent of what he thought Bladud did. Almost every barrow or rock or hill fort, John Wood attributed in some way to Bladud and his druids. John Wood believed there were a sun and moon temple on Lansdowne, and that the Royal Crescent and the circus are inspired by these two things that John Wood found. Only, until recently, no one had bothered to look for these places that John Wood claimed were sun and moon temples. So let's start with the sun temple. He made meticulous plans of Stonehenge and Stanton Drew, and every single stone that he recorded is still there now, exactly where he said it was. So there's no reason to doubt that he saw these stones lying in this field. The stones are not there now. They could have been some sort of stone circle with a circular foundation, but all of that has disappeared. Anything that could have been excavated or had geophysics done on it has disappeared because of all of the work that's happened there since. John Wood's is the only record of them. They probably disappeared not long after he died, which was shortly after he finished the book.
What a shame.
So there's the Moon Temple, and that is still there. And Bathscape have done some work on that recently.
Tell me more.
I'll tell you a bit, and then maybe we'll go visit it.
Oh, yes, let's.
I'll tell you how John Wood describes it. So first of all, he talks about St. Lawrence's Chapel, which is now a farmhouse opposite the Chalcombe Inn. He says, about the middle of the summit of this mountain, we see an ancient chapel turned to profane uses. Land being a British word signifying a church or sacred place, we accordingly find the remains of a circular work of about 30 feet diameter near the profane chapel on Lansdowne. This circular work was undoubtedly a temple of the moon.
Okay. Where are we going, Mike?
Oh yeah, we're going to go to the Chalcombe Inn. John Wood said that it was near to St. Lawrence's Chapel. And can you see this farmhouse here that looks a bit like a church on the end?
I can.
That is in fact St. Lawrence's Chapel.
So, no, it's so like a chapel when you tell me it's a chapel, but I would never have seen that.
What we're looking for is a circular feature about 30 feet diameter.
Okay.
With some several smaller mounds. And possibly an association with the Lansdowne Fair, which John Wood thought was instituted in pagan times. And we are about to come to a field that was formerly known as the Fairfield, which is this field right here. Can you see there's a small barrow there, a small globular mound?
I can.
And here, buried underneath the scrub, we're going to see a much larger mound. Watch your feet, because there's a lot of nettles.
Mike's heading straight into the scrub.
A few years ago, Bathscape did in fact do some clearance work on this mound that was stood on, and you could probably see the shape of it, but unfortunately it's grown up again. It could do with another session, maybe in the autumn. But we are stood on a Bronze Age round barrow.
Look at this. I mean, it's very distinct, isn't it?
And if you were to measure it, at least the bit that's the main hump, it is around 30 feet diameter. It is right opposite St. Lawrence's Chapel and in the Fairfield, with these two globular mounds. There's one big one and one very slight one next to it. Almost certainly this is the place that John Wood was talking about when he said that there was a moon temple up on Lansdowne.
We're right on top of it, you mean?
We're right on top of it.
How amazing.
Now, it almost certainly was not a Druidic temple. It was, in fact, excavated in the early 20th century, and they found, I think, a couple of cremations in here, and it's a very, very typical Bronze Age barrow.
So, this may seem like a ridiculous question, but is there a difference between a long barrow and a round barrow?
Yes. So, long barrows generally come from the Neolithic period, and they were often places of communal burial, where they would you'd often get bones of various individuals in there. It may have been some sort of a living temple where people could go in and be there with the bones of their ancestors, so that it wasn't just a place to throw them away and forget about them. Whereas round barrows are much later, they're from the Bronze Age, and times have changed a bit, and most round barrows are burials of individual people, and there's not usually any kind of entrance, so you can't go inside and see what's in there. They're usually right under the mound. And this is where he thought the Druids sacrificed to the change of the moon. There are several other related monuments, and if we've got time, we can go and have a wander and see them.
Let's go and look. Come on. It's the right day for it, because it's sunny.
Yeah.
Let's just get out of this nettle-filled scrub. Back down onto the pathway at the bottom. So what led you to think, well, I'm going to go and investigate this and see whether there's any truth in it, or I can find the buildings?
Well, when I read it, I presumed someone had already looked into it, so I tried to find out if anyone had written anything, and looked and looked and looked and couldn't find anything. So I thought, right, well, I'm going to go find this out. I didn't think it would take me that long. It took me a couple of years. Can you see in the distance we've got a couple of smaller barrows?
Oh, yes,
poking out over the wheat.
Yes, I can.
One of them was the barrow in which the gold-plated sun disk was found when they excavated it. And who knows what John Wood the Elder would have made of the gold sun disk if it had been found in his day.
Well, I was going to say, surely if you saw a sun disk, you might assume there was going to be a temple to the sun.
You might do, but we'll never know, because it was found after John Wood died, so.
Right, well, we're round the other side of this enormous wheat field.
What we've come to is an enormous trench with a stone wall on it.
Yes.
It's thought to be the outer defences of an Iron Age hill fort.
Look at that, it's quite a deep trench, isn't it?
It is a very deep trench.
So we can see over to Wales. We can probably see, we can certainly see the Mendips, but maybe the Quantocks in the background.
It's certainly a very good spot to have a hill fort. You can see the river. If you're worried about people coming from that direction, this is where you want to have some kind of an outpost, yeah. Some kind of defended place. And you'll see them coming from a very long way away. Be prepared. You see this track that goes through the middle of the field?
Yes.
So we think this is probably a Roman road and would have gone right across the wheat field. And heads on to North Stoke and possibly on to Bristol. Let's see what John Wood had to say about this place whilst we're here. We've done the real history or probable history of this place. Now let's have John Wood's interpretation.
So, the big tome is out again.
Upon the southern part of the extremity of Mons Bedonka, that is Lansdowne, a piece of ground appeared separated from the rest of the down by an entrenchment, which is what we just walked across. This is divided in the middle by a straight bank of earth directed to Canesham, and each part is adorned with a quadrangular barrow. To the westward of this work, the village of North Stoke is situated, and the hollow stem or trunk of the tree that gave name to the place must have been the object of adoration, which incense was burnt or some other religious ceremony performed in honour of the moon as queen of the heavenly bodies. Later on, he says, the pagans watching for the first appearance of the moon after a change upon their highest hills, no place on earth could be more proper for that purpose than the southwestward extremity of Mons Bedonka, in the entrenchment, therefore, that now appears on the summit of that part of the mountain. We may suppose Bladud to have placed his priests destined to watch for Onca's first appearance.
Wow.
This is
Mons Bedonka. But it's a great name.
Yes. He thought Onca was a moon goddess. Onca is a Phoenician goddess, and we actually know very little about her.
Right, so we're now going to go to our final destination. Are you going to tell me what that is, or is it going to be a surprise?
Well, I'll tell you what John Wood thought it was, and that was where King Bladud had raised the dead. He called it the Labyrinth.
Okay, we'll leave it there. We'll get there and we'll find out. You're going to tell us how much of any of that is true.
None of it.
So we've come right to the other end of Lansdowne, the monument end where the battle was fought. We've crossed the road and we're heading, oh look, there's a Civil War flag with probably some information attached to it.
So we've got this big mosaic of scrub and grassland, but underneath it is this great big area of banks and humps and ditches, and people for centuries have been wondering what it is. And the very first person to talk about it was John Wood. And his interpretation was as follows. To the northward of this entrenchment, which is the place we've just come from, above this sacred tree, North Stoke, we find a work that makes a mere labyrinth of holes, ditches, banks and barrows, but at the same time art discovers itself so much in the figure of the whole, as well as in the several parts, that I shall make no scruple in pronouncing it the work whereby King Bladud and his colleagues feign themselves able to raise up all the deities inhabitants of the infernal mansions in the practice of the art of necromancy. It's now thought that this was a quarry, and they're probably right about that.
Oh, John.
It is mentioned in a Saxon charter. We know this is very ancient because a Saxon charter, in fact several Saxon charters, call this Lutz Crundell. We're not sure what Lutz actually means. It probably is a Saxon personal name, but Crundell means quarry.
Okay. What do you mean, so it's an ancient quarry?
Well, it was certainly here in the 10th century when the Saxon charters were written. How long before that it was here, we don't know. But we do know just across the road, there's quite an extensive Roman settlement, and there has been suggestions that this is a Roman quarry.
Ooh, that's exciting. What did you just say these were called?
Badgel snuffle pits. That's where the badgers have been rooting around for food, like worms or roots. Badger snuffle pits.
Badger snuffle pits. There is literally nothing Mike doesn't know about. And if you're interested in finding out more about Mike's work on Lansdowne, he's written a paper on it, which you can find on the Bathscape website. Right, finally it's the turn of Charmydown, and I was keen to find out about the old wartime airfield up there. So I tracked down Howard Burton, who's written a book all about Charmydown during the Second World War, and he kindly agreed to be interviewed while on holiday. And I started by asking him how he came to write the book.
In the 1980s, I used to run marathons with a dear friend who sadly died, and one day he took me on a route over Salisbury Hill, and the fog was down, the mist was down, and we ended up on this very flat piece of land. I'd absolutely no idea where we were. Alistair, my friend, explained that we were on this airfield, the Second World War airfield. And as we were running back towards Bath, the mist lifted, and there was the control tower. Incredible sort of evocative moment. And Alistair had some anecdotes about it, all sorts of stories about the airfield. And over the years, I've met people who lived there, who've written about it. It was some dear friends of ours. Her uncle flew from there and was killed flying from there. A distant relative of mine was married to one of the guys who flew out from there. So it's a whole web of stories which I gradually put together.
So I guess it was used as an airfield in the Second World War because of its shape. I mean, it's very flat and...
Yes, the Seven Downs of Bath all have those flat tops. Charmydown, yes, I think is the flattest, although there was an airfield apparently on Lansdowne as well. But the airfield itself was built during 1940, after the Battle of Britain. It was built to house or to take aeroplanes that were going to defend not Bath, but Bristol and the South Wales ports. In those days, they always built two airfields close to each other in case one was put out by enemy action. Charmydown is actually what we call a satellite, in other words, the minor airfield to Killurn.
Okay.
So Killurn is the big airfield, but Charmydown has its own history. In late 1940, the aeroplanes that were based there were the so-called night fighters, because by this time, Germany were bombing Britain during the night. And so Britain needed these aeroplanes to try and intercept the incoming German bombers on their way to bomb Bristol and the South Wales ports.
So it's had a rich history. Tell me a story of what happened up there during the Second World War.
I'll give you two to start with. I mentioned that it became fully operational in the autumn of 1940. But in the summer of 1940, as most of your listeners will probably know, we had what was called the Battle of Britain, where the German Air Force was trying to destroy the Royal Air Force, Britain's Air Force, prior to a land invasion from the northern coast of France. The Battle of Britain was, if you like, won by the RAF at a huge cost. But the German Air Force commander, Goring, then decided, rather than try and shoot the British planes out of the sky, that they would bomb them on the ground. And on the 13th of August 1940, Goring launched what he called Eagle Day, which was an all-out offensive against airfields across the south of Britain. And the reason this is important as far as the history of Charmydown is concerned is that on the 17th of August, we have the first fatalities at Charmy Down. A very sad story. Again, you will probably know, and most of your listeners will know, that during that Second World War, there was a large Home Guard to try and protect Britain in case of an invasion by air, particularly. And two of the Home Guard members were on guard duty that early morning of Saturday of the 17th of August. Henry Pickford, who was a local farmer from Langridge, and Albert Simmons, who originally came from Sussex. No one really knows what happened, but an unexploded bomb exploded when possibly they went to investigate it. They were killed outright, and they were the first casualties. And it's a very evocative story. I have a picture in the book of Henry Pickford with his daughter, Marianne, when she was about 3 years old. It can only have been taken a few weeks probably before he was killed. And so she really has very few memories of her father. But I've met Marianne, she's now Marianne Brunt, and she has a commemoration scroll that is dedicated to her father, Henry Pickford. And it's a very sad story, as of course are many others. Flying Officer Pete Roscoe, he was a member of 87 Squadron, which was the night fighters, the Hawker Hurricanes, which were based at Charmy Down. When planes were based at Charmy Down, they didn't always just stay there. They would be dispersed across the southwest. They went as far down as the Sillies, and there was an airfield there. And Pete Roscoe and Alex Tom, his wingman, when they were flying from the Sillies, actually shot down a German bomber in the English Channel. Once they saw that the aeroplane had crashed into the sea, they saw that the crew had actually managed to get out and get themselves into a dinghy. So Pete Roscoe radioed the lifeboat at St. Mary's in the Sillies, and the German crew were able to be picked up and obviously became prisoners of war. And in the Roscoe family story is that Pete Roscoe and I think Alex Tom met the crew on the Sillies, and the crew, the German crew, were grateful, obviously, that their basically lives had been saved. And the only thing that they could give Pete and Alex were their life jackets. And so they had them as a thank you for saving their lives. And that was a, you know, one of those stories that, despite what war is, horrible, humanity comes through. But a sad end to this part of the story was that when Pete Roscoe was at Charmy Down, he met Anne Brock, who was a cipher officer at Cullern, very important post, who was responsible for coding and decoding messages. They met and they fell in love, and they were married on the 18th of January 1942 at Cullern Church, and they had the reception of what was the officers' mess at Ashwick House, which is obviously still there. Sadly, virtually 5 weeks later, on the 24th of February, Pete was killed. He was taking part in a low flying exercise up in Gloucestershire on a firing range, and he flew too low and he collided with overhead wires, and his plane crashed and he was killed instantly. Very, very sad.
That's terribly sad.
The final bit of the war story was D-Day and the Americans in Bath. Again, very significant socially, culturally. Charmy Down was an important logistics base on the preparation for D-Day. And there's, again, lovely stories of Bath taxi drivers telling me that they have memories of, from the 60s onwards, of elderly Americans getting older and older each year, arriving at Bath Spa, and rather than wanting to be taken to the baths or the abbey, asked to be taken up to the airfield, which is where they were based. And again, talking to some of the children as they were then, but obviously quite elderly now, have these memories of these kind of heroes that came in looking so fit and well-fed, who would be chucking sweets out as they drove through the gates onto Charmydown and the kids getting them. As the Second World War was finishing, there were homeless families in Bath and, of course, elsewhere, and they needed rehousing. So as the airfield was no longer required, families had been bombed out of Bath and elsewhere, moved into the accommodation that had originally housed the RAF personnel who lived there. The Ministry of Health promoted these occupations. The buildings themselves were improved. And instead of having Hut 93, we now had Number 9 Elm Grove. The Nissen huts, as they were, became people's houses. And instead of being a serial number on a military plan, talked about, as I say, Number 33 Lime Grove or Ash Grove. And at its height, there was a school, there was an off license, a post office. I think they even tried to show films. And I think there was at least 50 to 60 families living there. And again, I've managed to talk to some of them, and they remember it very fondly. It was very tough times. And in one particular memory is in that very hard winter of 1947. Some of the people I've spoken to, they can remember tobogganing down the slopes around Charmydown on old car doors.
Wow.
And being chased by a ram owned by the local farmer. The village basically lasted 10 years. And once they left, there was a secret radar station built due to the threat of Russian atomic bombers making war on Britain in the mid-1950s. And today it's back to where it started. It's arable land, and it's also an important catchment area for Wessex Water.
Howard, thank you so much for talking to me today about it all.
It's been a great pleasure, and thanks for giving me the opportunity to share this story with you and your listeners.
Thanks so much to Howard Burton. And one of the stories Howard mentioned was the sad death of Henry Pickford. And if you want to find out more about his family and the farm he owned, Manor Farm in the Langridge Valley, episode 3 features the farm and his daughter, Marianne Brunt. Well, that's it for this episode of Footprints. Thanks to all those who took part, and you can find links, as ever, to all the items in the show notes. Do email us with any suggestions or comments at info@bathscape.co.uk. And for more information, you can visit the website bathscape.co.uk. Don't forget, you can listen to all the previous episodes anytime you like. And please do share as widely as you can with friends, family and colleagues. Thanks too to the National Lottery Heritage Fund and players of the National Lottery for supporting our work. Footprints was hosted and produced by me, Pommy Harmer, and I'll see you next month.